You're listening to Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast, a clear voice in chaotic times.
In Psalm 40, David combines a number of emotions in a very powerful manner. And he begins his psalm with a joyful response of praise to God for an answer to prayer that was to him overwhelming, where the King of the universe, the Creator of all things, had stooped down, bent near, come close, and had answered his prayer. And David's words in verse 3 of that psalm have been a memory verse for many and the life verse for my father. And the words are, he's put a new song in my mouth, a praise to our God. Many will see and will fear and will trust in the Lord. Today I want to tell you a story of the writing of a song. And at the end of the service, Chaplain Bill Bryan and his wife Shirley are going to play and sing that song. Boise, Idaho was an unusual location for the Billy Graham team to come, but they came there about 20 years ago for a week-long campaign. And very dear friends of ours, Beverly's and mine, lived there, Carl and Helen Johnson. And Carl was a banker, but a very active Christian layman, and he was asked to be the chairperson for the Billy Graham Crusade. He worked on it very, very hard, and when things were ready, he phoned us about a week before, and he said, "Ron, if you and Bev come to Boise for the weekend, stay with us, I'll see that you get to sit on the platform with Billy Graham." And I thought, boy, that's worth a trip to Boise. So we made that trip, and when we arrived, Beverly went with Helen and sat in the near audience, and I went with Carl into a room where we were given instructions on how to sit on a platform. And we were told to pay attention, to sit up straight, no gum chewing. It was really good stuff for people to sit on. But in case you all lose interest, I have something to pass around to you. It'll make sense later. So as these instructions were being given, I noticed a commotion by the door. And there was a uniformed, armed security person with my friend Carl, and they were motioning for me to come over to the door, and I did, and Carl introduced me to this man, and then he said, "May I see your ID?" Well, I showed him my driver's license, and he said, "Now, I hate to have you do this, but would you just spread eagle against the wall?" Well, I watch television, so I did that, and he patted me down and went over me with a wand, and then he said, "Well, you appear to be clean." And I said, "Well, it was a 10-hour drive, but I'm doing the best I can." And he said, "Well, follow me." And I did, down one hall and another, and then into an open area where there was a small house trailer, a mobile home. And he knocked on the door, and I heard the voice I've heard all my life say, "Come in." And my friend Carl had worked out for me a private interview with Billy Graham. I couldn't believe it. You know, for a Baptist preacher, that's the equivalent of a Catholic having an audience with the Pope. And he said, "Come on in." And he says, "May I take off your jacket?" He says, "May I call you Ron?" And I said, "Certainly, Dr. Graham." And he said, "I want to talk to you about your father and about his song." And, well, I thought that was really terrific. And I realized later I was there about 25 minutes. And then there was a voice that came over a speaker embedded in the wall above the couch where I was seated. And there was this voice saying, "Dr. Graham, it's time for you and your guest to make your way to the platform." I thought, "Isn't that neat, you and your guest?" And so I followed him, and the meeting had already begun. But we strode out, and there was the center seat, which he took, and then was my friend Carl, and then there was the seat with my name on it. And to my right was Sandy, can you believe it, Patty, right there. And I thought, wait till I get back to Western and tell the guys where I've been. This can't get any better than this. But I was wrong, because as he always does, just before the sermon, George Beverly Shea came up to sing. As he stood up, and he was way down on the front row, but the last seat down, when he stood up, I heard the pianist and organist begin the introduction to my father's song. And he was singing it the day I was there. I just couldn't believe it. And when he started singing, Billy Graham reached around my friend Carl and grabbed my left arm and squeezed it. And he said, this is really something, isn't it? And that's all it took, and I began to bawl, and my wife was destroying a box of Kleenex with Helen. And so then when he was done, he went and sat down. And then Billy Graham came up to the pulpit and looked out, and then he didn't start his sermon. But instead, he looked over to where Bev Shea was, and then he looked to where I was, and then back to where Shea was. And he said, now, George, when you began singing today, you had no idea that the son of the composer of the song was seated right here. And he did a double take, and he stood up, and Billy Graham just stood there, and Bev Shea walked across the platform, came to where I was, and I stood up, and he gave me a bear hug, and he said, are you doing anything after the meeting? Would you care to go to dinner with me? And I said, we'd all planned to go bowling. All right, that's a joke. I didn't say that. But that night, three couples, Carl and Helen, John and Evie, and Beverly and I, joined him for dinner and talked about the song. And what I want to tell you about today is the song of my father. And I am going to be dropping names shamelessly. Wantonly, with no regard for decency. I'm going to drop name after name. But there are two things that mitigate this. The first is, most of you are so young, you won't know who these names are anyway. But the second thing, I want you all to know that I know that all of these names together are names of passing celebrity, and they all pale beside the name of Savior Jesus, to which name glory will accrue increasingly, exponentially throughout eternity. So I'll be talking about lesser names, but I want you to know the real name is Jesus. My father was born into a home that was filled with music. His father was a barber who loved to sing, and yes, in barbershop quartets. And his mother was a classical pianist, a concert artist, and a music teacher in Denver. And my father tells the story, and it was written in the Rocky Mountain News, of the time when his mother, when he was quite young, his mother suffered a minor stroke and was confined to bed for a number of weeks. And they hired a housekeeper to take care of things and the little boy during her illness. And one day, my grandmother was getting better, and she began to hear slowly and haltingly the melody line of a classical piece. And after a while, she realized what it was. It was the theme from Humoresque, and she had been playing that song when she had her stroke. And so she got out of bed one day and came to the stairwell and looked down, and the housekeeper was steadying the 18-month-old child on the piano bench, and with one finger, he was picking out that melody line. And my grandmother realized she had an extraordinary prodigy in her family. And she began pouring everything she knew about music into her little boy, Barclay. She babied him as well. He was no longer a child. He was her little Mozart. And so he was babied. He was the center of her life. And in junior high, he was taking lessons on 9 different instruments, because my grandmother believed not only would he be an artist one day, but he would compose and arrange, and he needed to know how instruments worked. In high school at Manual Arts High in Denver, he was first chair violinist in the school orchestra, first chair trumpet player in the school band, played organ Sunday mornings at the First Christian Church, and led a dance band Friday and Saturday nights. So his life was a life of music. When he graduated from high school, my father did two things right away. The first was to marry Vantoria Hahn, my mother-to-be, and right out of high school. And then he broke his mother's heart by turning down a full scholarship to a very famous music school in New York City because he didn't want to go on in classical music, which was her dream for him. He wanted to go into the popular music of his day, and that was big band swing. For my grandmother, if it wasn't Bach, Beethoven, or Brahms, it wasn't music. But my father discovered Teddy Wilson and the great jazz and swing artists of his day, and that's the music he wanted to play. My grandmother didn't talk to my father for a long time. She was really broken over that. But he got a job at a radio station. In those days, radio stations that played that had played recorded music had to have a certain number of hours of every broadcast day with live studio musicians. It was a great job for musicians. And so he did the morning drive-in show in Denver for a number of years on KXL. And while he was there, he began developing friendships, and those friendships, that networking, would last him for his career. During the war years, that's World War II for you younger people, during the war years, he was not in the service. He had fallen early, broken an ankle, it had healed badly. So his service was to play at a defense plant, and the music was piped through the plant. That's an important part of the story, that he wasn't in the service. In 1945, as soon as people could move again, we moved as a family from Denver to Hollywood, California, where my dad wanted to make it big. I was born in 41, you can figure out that real quickly, and my sister was born in 43. I can't believe that my sister is 63 years old. How did that happen? But we moved to California, and my father began playing as a guest with a number of big bands in those days, got to know a lot of people, became the accompanist for Jane Russell, whom you may know from movies and from late-night ads of foundation garments. But Jane Russell was also a wonderful singer, and my dad became her friend, and she became a lifelong friend. She's just turned 80 just a few weeks ago. That's hard to believe, isn't it? But she is a wonderful Christian woman, and these days living very close to the Lord in Arizona. But my father's big break came, as they used to say, when he was invited to join Freddie Martin's band. Now, many of you will not know that name at all, but in the 30s and 40s, Freddie Martin's band was very well known. And Freddie would take classical themes, and he would set them to dance band rhythms. And his theme song was from a Tchaikovsky piano concerto in B-flat, and he called it Tonight We Love. And he always featured a classically trained pianist. And before my father, Jack Fina and Murray Arnold, and then my dad. And we have, in our home in Oregon, a collection of 78 records. In an iPod world, you have no idea what those are. But these are glass records with one song on each side, and 78 is how many times they go around a minute. And it's one song on each side, and on the labels, it says Freddie Martin's Orchestra, with Barclay Allen at the piano. Well, I could talk about this, but you need to hear it. My father traveled with Freddie for a number of months. They did many, many recordings. My father wrote a song that's still played today. My mother, my sister, and I still get royalty checks from over 60 countries in the world from this song. The checks aren't as big as they used to be, but it's fascinating that they still keep coming 60 years later. So I want you to hear the song, Kumana. And this is the original recording, 1947. It's my father's song. He's playing the piano, and it's with Freddie Martin's big band. Okay. Well, that record in 1947 sold over 1 million copies in a time when that was a big number, and it was recorded many, many times by others. And with that and other songs that I showed you sheet music of, he decided it was time to start his own band. And there was one day when Freddie's band was still in New York on Broadway, and Dad showed up on our front door. Taxi driver left him off. My mother said, "Bark, what's happened? Did you get fired?" "No, I quit." "You quit? You're the highest paid sideman in the country, according to Downbeat magazine. How could you quit?" "Well, I'm ready to live out my dream." Well, he got musicians together. He got a wonderful personal manager named Carson Harris. And after rehearsals, the band opened at a place called Ciro's. And in those days, bands would play for years with the hope that one day they'd make it to Ciro's. Dad's band opened there. Peggy Lee, you just saw her picture, was the headliner. And Frank Sinatra was there. I told you, Shameless. My mother shook hands with Perry Como that night. She said she didn't wash her hand for 3 days. It was such an exciting time. And the band was booked for a few weeks. It was lengthened for several months. And then Carson Harris, the agent, and my dad told us that the band was going on tour for 2 years. And my mother said, "No, you're not." Not alone. He had traveled before with Freddie's band for several months. He'd been traveling with Jane Russell and her ensemble for a number of months. She says, "This time we're going as family." And so that was a very unusual thing, because in those days, dance bands traveled either by train or by bus. But we went by family car and caravan. And the drummer in my father's band was a teacher certified by the state of California. And so he became our teacher of record and gave materials to our mothers. And we didn't have homeschool, we had hotel school. Because our mothers would lead us through the lessons, and then we'd do exams, and the state of California would approve that. So that was really something. Now, for a young boy, this was just a lark. For 2 years, I'd never have one chore. You know, there's nothing to pick up, because we're living in a hotel suite with maid service daily. And there's no dishes to dry, because we're eating every meal out for 2 years. And all I had to do was read books and enjoy the parks and the zoos that our mothers would take us to. It was incredible. But for my mother, it wasn't a lark. It turned out to be a very difficult time. All she had to do was to take care of two children, and all she had to do was to take care of two children. And she wasn't preparing meals, and so she wasn't preparing meals. And she wasn't cleaning the house or caring for a home, so she wasn't doing anything except with us. And she began looking for meaning in her life, and she bought an Edgar Meyer's Bible storybook and read it aloud to us twice, cover to cover. And I don't know why she did that. It's just she thought maybe that would be good to do. When the band, the band played in big hotels, the Palmer House in Chicago, Chase Hotel in St. Louis, the Peabody in Memphis, these grand old hotels, and the band would be there for 6 to 8 months in each one. When we were in the Chase Hotel, the female vocalist in my dad's band began pressuring my mother to take my sister and me to church. This is a very odd thing if you think about it. Female vocalist in a dance band was upset at the band leader's wife because her children weren't going to church. And one day, my mother and this vocalist saw a sign, a placard, on the lobby desk. And it was about a Bible class for children near our hotel. So my mother took us there, and it must have been child evangelism. It had to have been. And there was a flannel graph board. It was child evangelism. There was a heart. There was a door, a shiny knob, a verse from Revelation that I don't want Dr. Honer to hear about. And she said, "All you need to do is to ask Jesus to come into your lives, and he'll be with you forever." And that night, when my parents were fighting in their room about my father's increasing drinking problem, I prayed the prayer that she taught me that day and became the first in our family to know Jesus. Things, though, went from not very good to much worse with my parents. My father was now flagrantly unfaithful to my mother and was drinking so heavily that sometimes I would be polishing his shoes, my mother would be heating soup on an illegal hot plate in our suite, and we'd have the radio on, the band was already playing a national broadcast, and he wasn't on the stand yet. So things were not going well at all. Fame had come too easily and too quickly, and it was going to destroy him. And my mother finally decided she couldn't do it anymore. So she packed up things, and we flew back to California. Meanwhile, the band headed west, and they went to Seattle, and then to Portland, and then to the Mark Hopkins in San Francisco. And then the last stop before the dream job was the Cal Naval Lodge in California, Lake Tahoe. The dream job was in Las Vegas. Carson Harris had worked out the most lucrative contract that a dance band had ever had to be the house band at a new casino in Las Vegas. And that was going to be my dad's life. And the last stop before that was the Cal Naval Lodge, right on the border, hence the name. And it was a September morning. My dad spent the day with Frank Sinatra, who had a chalet there. And my wife and I visited there recently, and we saw that the ballroom at the Cal Naval Lodge is today called the Frank Sinatra Ballroom. So he was very often there. But my dad spent the day with him, and they reminisced about the last 2 years, about how well the band had done, and the records that were being sold and played, and it was all very, very exciting, and they drank pretty heavily all day long. And then that night, Frank came with my father and sang, and that was a big crowd pleaser, unexpected, and my father kept drinking. And then he got into a tiff with someone after the show, and decided to drive off by himself to Reno to gamble. Even today, the highway along that stream is a windy road, but back then was more narrow than it is today, the Truckee River. And my father was in the middle of the night in a car that was only 4 weeks old, a brand new Buick Roadmaster with four holes. And he fell asleep at the wheel, and he had a horrible accident. He was found the next day by two people fishing along the stream. They flagged down a car, and he was rushed to the Washoe County Hospital in Reno. The drummer, Merle Mahone, was taken to the accident site by a highway patrolman, and he showed where my father's car had gone through a barrier, where the car had dislodged a large boulder, and where in pre-seatbelt days, my father was thrown partly out of the car as it tumbled down an 18-foot embankment. And the boulder landed, my father beside it in the car atop the both, and the boulder actually kept the car from killing him. But from his broken wristwatch, they knew that he had been lying there for 5.5 hours when he was found, and he'd been in horrible pain. And when it was all sorted out, he'd broken his neck, he'd injured his spinal column, he was paralyzed from this level down. He would never walk again. He'd never be able to play like he played again. And he was not yet 30 years old. And his life was over. I remember a phone call. I'll never forget my mother screaming and crying, frenetic activity, running around, making calls. Finally, a taxi coming, a lady getting out of the taxi with her suitcases, my mother getting on after hugging us. The lady was going to stay with my sister and me as my mother flew to Reno to be with my dad. When she got there, she found him in a room on a Stryker frame. That's a rotational bed. They had the technology then, but he was unattended, and he was in the process of swallowing his tongue. His face was blue. My mother screamed, and they came in, and his life was saved, but it was a very difficult setting. When he finally came to the realization that he would never be able to walk again, and never be able to play the way he had played, he decided he just didn't want to live. Christopher Reeve, the movie star, was heroic as he faced his injuries. My father wasn't. He wasn't a hero at all. And he just was absolutely broken. Weeks went by. He was flown by a hospital plane to the to Burbank, California, St. Joseph's Hospital, where he was hospitalized for 21 months. And he went from 200 pounds to 87 pounds. I mentioned the fact he wasn't in the Army. That's a significant part of his story. The hospital where Johnny was treated is called Rancho Los Amigos, and I've been there. It's a marvelous hospital. It was built to deal with spinal injuries from World War II connected disabilities. Because my father hadn't been in the service and his accident was from drunken driving, he didn't qualify to be in there, even though his doctors pleaded that he get a bed there. So he didn't get the rehabilitation that Johnny and countless others got. And by Johnny's time, of course, it was a hospital open to all. So he really floundered. And my mother, though, was met by the pastor of the church, of the lady who was caring for us when the plane arrived from Reno, Pastor Norm Hammer, a wonderful Lutheran pastor who was an aggressive evangelist. And he said to my mom, "You need help, and I want to be there to help you. And among the help, we have a Bible class for adults, Saturday mornings. I want you to be there Saturday." On the third Saturday, explaining justification by grace through faith, my mother heard that, and she came to faith. And then my sister. Now we're praying for my dad. And he had had nothing to do with it. I'd cry. He'd say, "Ronnie, I know. You love Jesus. That's fine. You're a little boy. And your mom, she needs it. But I don't. For me, religion is strictly see melody. Just don't bother me with it." Pastor tried to talk to him. He had a wonderful sense of humor. And he'd come in and he'd say a joke at the nurse's station. And then he'd laugh. His laugh was better than his joke. And then my dad would hear the laughter. And he'd call out to a nurse, "Nurse, tell that man I'm dead, or tell him I'm in therapy, but don't tell him I'm here." And he'd pull across the curtain and say, "Hiya, Bark, how you doing today?" My dad would pretend to be asleep. He'd say, "I know you're not asleep. I heard you yelling at the nurse." He'd say, "You know, there's a guy named Pete. He's on the third floor. He really needs you. Go see him. I don't want to talk to you." So that's what it was for 21 months. Then there came a day where it was different. There was a phone call again. And my mother was sort of a repeat of what it had been 2 years before. Screaming and crying and phone calls and frenetic activity. Someone had called from the hospital saying to my mother that, "Mrs. Allen, your husband is out of coma," which he'd been in, "but he's failing. His vital signs are very weak. We believe he's dying. He's asking for you. We know you come every evening, but would you come this morning? So she called Pastor Hammer, and they went together. When they came into his room, the doctors didn't want him even to go in, but my dad was pleading. So my mother went in. My dad said to her, "Van," her name, I feel like I'm dying, but I cannot die before I tell you how sorry I am for the way I've treated you. I've been unfaithful to you. I've been unkind to you. I've loved you, but I've not shown my love, and I can't die with this guilt without asking you to forgive me for the way I've treated you all these years." And my mother said, "If you really love me, Bark, why are you trying so hard to leave me?" And it's the same thing. It's because I can't live without the music. She went out. Pastor went in. Doctor tried to stop him. Says, "I don't think he wants you in there." And he says, "Well, that's all right. I don't think too much of him right now myself, but I'm going in." So he came in and he looked at my dad, and this time my dad couldn't play games. And Pastor came to my dad's bed and leaned against it gently so he wouldn't cause these horrible spasms my father would have as there was a jolt. And he'd say, "You know, it's time, old buddy, to begin taking care of your widow and orphans." And my dad looked at him with a little bit of anger, and then he said, "You know, old buddy, if you really knew where you were going, you wouldn't be in such a hurry to get there." And then he said, my father said, "What right do you have to talk to a dying man like that?" And swore at him. And Pastor said, "I tell you what, old buddy, if you're still around tomorrow, I'll answer that and any other question you may have, and he strode out of the room.
Hello, I'm the real Barclay Allen.
And I'm Norm Hammer.
I was fighting mad at the preacher, and all night long I thought of questions. Without my knowing it, why, he had given me an incentive to live through the night. The next morning, I shot a million questions at him, and Pastor Hammer always knew the right answers. Didn't you, Norm?
Well, Bark, occasionally you stump me. But there's one place where you can always find the answer.
My friends thought Norm had been rougher on me than a pastor had any right to be, but they were wrong. Time and time again, he had tried to reach me with love and understanding of my need, but that approach didn't work. God used Norm and my wonderful sweet wife, Fan, to show me how to live.
But it wasn't easy for Barclay. There was no sudden miracle which eased the pain.
But God did give me the fortitude to put up with it. There was no sunburst of energy in which my paralyzed muscles came to life, but he did help me find the patience for the long struggle.
Nor was there an immediate determination to find and live a useful life.
I heard a multiple recording by Les Paul and his guitars, and I felt that I might be able to do the same thing with the piano. So RCA Victor agreed to try it, and the result was Cherokee and After You've Gone.
I never will forget the day I called on Barclay, and he told me he'd written a new song. The old Barclay was gone. I saw a new Barclay, full of eagerness for life and accomplishment. I'd expected something like Barclay's Boogie or Kumanaw. Instead, it was the beautifully modern hymn, I Found a Friend, words by Rock Hillman. You've probably heard it. Joe Stafford, George Beverly Shea, and Kenny Baker have all recorded it. You see, our point in telling you Barclay's story is this. No matter what your life has been in the past, no matter what you have done, you can throw away your mistakes. And because God forgives, you can be born again. And to be born again means to have a new life. And here's a man who has a brand new life.
I certainly have. And being born again is the greatest thing that can happen to anyone. I was burdened with guilt, but when I saw in God's holy word that Christ died for my sins, I took God at his word, and he forgave me. Something wonderful happened inside, and I've been different ever since. It happened to me. I hope you'll let it happen to you.
Life seemed not worth living. I found a friend so tender and forgiving. I can't conceive how such a thing could be, that Jesus cares for he. Each day, each year, my faith in him is growing. He's ever near, his love is overflowing. I'll have no fear, my worldly cares are few. I found a friend, and life began anew. I found a friend, and he is your friend too. I found a friend, and now he walks beside me, his hand to lend, to comfort and to guide me. When clouds appear, I talk with him a while. He's taught this heart of mine to smile. Because he came, my soul shall live in glory. I'll praise his name and tell my Savior's story. What friend so true would give his all for you? I found a friend and life began.